Well, hello again, everybody out there in Turdville. This is your weekly Access to Access webinar. We do this every Thursday for subscribers, giving you a chance to interact, ask questions of the biggest movers and shakers in the metals industry. And today we have, I just can't help but think he's basically a legend. You know, I hate to say that though, James, because it's like if somebody calls you a legend, it like makes you seem like you're really old. James Turk is a legend. He is, he's forgotten more about the metals business than I'll ever know. And so it's an honor to call him a friend, and it's just a great treat to have him here, within a TFMR A2A webinar. James is the founder of Gold Money. He is one of the world's foremost experts on the international gold trade. And his most recent book that he co-authored with John Rubino is called The Money Bubble. And you'll see a link to that here on this podcast page. I encourage you to check it out if you haven't already. James, thank you so much for making some time and stopping by Turdville today.
Yeah, Craig, it's always great to be with you.
Hey, before we go anywhere and before we start getting into the questions, I just want to express my excitement in what you have done in merging Gold Money with BitGold. I am now a BitGold account holder myself. I just couldn't be more excited about what you are doing there. In that, I mean, we all save in dollars. We've all been conditioned to save in dollars our whole lives, but yet the dollars that we save in and all of our accumulated work and effort is constantly being devalued by these dastardly central bankers. And now here's a way to save in gold and actually pay your bills in gold. James, I couldn't be more excited, but tell everybody a little bit about why and how and you know, why you would merge in with BitGold and what you think the opportunity is there.
Yeah, we're really quite excited about it. I first met Roy Sabag, who is the founder of BitGold, in end of April, and we had a very good discussion, a couple good follow-up discussions, and it quickly became apparent to both him and us at Gold Money that we both had strengths, and that the strengths that we brought to the table were complementary to one another, with the consequence that we viewed the transaction as a 1 + 1 = 3. In other words, the combined company is greater than the sum of its parts, simply because of bringing together the strengths of both companies. And so far, it's worked out very, very well, and I'm quite optimistic and excited about the future. As the two companies become further integrated, I think we are going to be a force to be reckoned with in the gold industry. I'm quite excited about it, Craig. It's worked well, and I think it's going to continue to work well.
Great way to just ingrain more use of gold and recognition of gold as money for just regular people. Because, it just takes, a couple $100 to open an account. You actually own fully allocated gold. I had to pick where I wanted mine vaulted when I signed up. I'm going to give you one of the listener questions, or actually subscriber questions. It was emailed to me. I'm just going to get to this right now because it kind of fits in what we're talking about. A guy named Neil wanted to know how soon the Gold Money platform will integrate into the BitGold platform, and that you could, transfer some of your vaulted Gold Money holdings into a BitGold account and vice versa. Is that something that you can speak to at all?
Yeah, it's being worked on. It's envisioned. When it comes to computer programming and developing a business integration, it doesn't happen overnight. The deal was announced in May. It took several weeks for the attorneys to cross all of the T's and dot all of the I's, and that only happened a couple weeks ago. Mm-hmm. So it's going to happen soon. Let's talk in terms of a couple of months maybe. I don't want to be committed to that, though, because when you're bringing something like this to the table, it could take a little bit longer, but it is going ahead full steam ahead.
Well, I couldn't be more enthusiastic about what you're doing. And I'm proud to be associated with BitGold, and I hope to add them as a side advertiser in the future. And like I said, I own my own account there, too. I think it's just great. All right, I want to kind of dive right into the questions that I have for you. Like I said, I consider you, one of the, if not the world's foremost expert on global gold trading and global gold delivery and the global gold market, not just this paper stuff. one of the challenges that I have as an analyst at this point, James, is measuring physical tightness. GOFO, computed by the LBMA, used to be helpful. And then all of a sudden it went historically negative last November and they decided to stop printing it. Imagine that. You talk a lot about measuring backwardation, spot versus front month futures. But I'm constantly trying to find other ways that I can, anecdotal bits of evidence as to measure how tight things are. I mean, you have any advice for me and for everybody else? What do you think is the best way to measure physical tightness versus the declining paper price?
Yeah, there is no one silver bullet. You have to put a number of different pieces of anecdotal evidence together. And I like what you've done recently with your analysis of the COMEX positions. I think that's very, very interesting. But, again, it's just one piece of evidence. So imagine, if you were grabbing a foot of an elephant, you would come away with the conclusion that this is something pretty big, but you'd have no idea what the elephant would look like. Yeah. It's the same thing when you grab that COMEX data. You've hit the nail on the head in concluding that, hey, this is something big, but what does the rest of the picture look like? Well, the rest of the picture is the things that we, are seeing elsewhere. We're seeing that spot gold in London trades above the 1 or 2 month forward delivery for gold. We're seeing things like, the GOFO rate is no longer reported because they don't want it to be reported to show the backwardation in gold. We're seeing the U.S. Mint selling 5 times more gold in July than they were selling a year ago. Yeah. The Mint also making it difficult to acquire silver coins because they stopped selling those until later in this month, as I understand it. So, piece by piece, you can build up the entire picture, and before you know it, that you got the elephant there, and it's a question of just looking at all of this data that's out there and coming up with a basic conclusion that there's a physical shortage building in the metals market at these prices. Now, here's the key thing, and we can compare it to what happened back in the 1960s when you had the central bank cartel called the London Gold Pool, which tried to keep gold at $35 an ounce when the market knew that gold was worth more than $35 an ounce.
Yep.
It's the same thing that's happening today, the difference being that the price was fixed back then. Today the price fluctuates a little bit and isn't fixed, but you can see these movements of metal. Back then the movements of metal was out of Fort Knox. There was 10,000 tons of gold taken out of Fort Knox in the 1960s to try to keep gold at $35 an ounce. Today we're seeing the movement not only gold coming out of the Federal Reserve and heading from west to east, but gold also coming out of England, Great Britain, coming out of Switzerland. And again, it's moving from west to east, being gobbled up in places like India and China, where people appreciate the advantage of owning physical metal. So, we're seeing an unusual set of circumstances. And I think it's ultimately going to lead to a higher gold price, just like when they finally threw in the towel in March of 1968.
Right.
You had 12 more years of rising gold prices. So we've got many years ahead of a rising gold price.
Well, and that's a perfect segue, I guess, into my second question for you, is that where is the gold coming from? Because the only legitimacy to the paper price, which is derived through all this derivative trading, the only legitimacy comes from actual physical deliveries at that price. That gives the paper price legitimacy. We had the Ken Hoffman at Bloomberg tell us a couple years ago about the vaults being empty in London, 26 million ounces of gold gone. We get the global demand numbers, the global export numbers showing that, like Steve Santangelo documents every month, gold exports out of the US or gold exports out of the UK into Switzerland and out of Switzerland to the East. And there's gold flowing. But again, from where is it coming? Because when the point that those wells run dry is when the whole system finally collapses.
Yeah, that's right. Well, first of all, you've got 8 tons a day coming out of mines. Thereabouts.
Okay.
And so that has to be accounted for. It's like constantly increasing the money supply by 8 tons a day, in this case being the gold money supply. But if gold is too low of a price, the only other way it's going to come from is the existing above ground stock. You know, if the Federal Reserve wants to create dollars, they go out and print them or create a bookkeeping entry on their computer, and they can create whatever amount of dollars they want. Same for any other central bank. You know, the ECB can create euros out of thin air. But gold, physical gold, doesn't come out of thin air. It comes out of the ground with a lot of hard work, a lot of capital, a lot of investment, and, you know, taking a lot of risk, which is what gold mining is all about.
Yep.
So you can't increase dramatically the price of gold if there's a shortage. What you have to do is comes from the existing above ground stocks. That's why I keep going back to March of 1968. You know, back then, the central banks threw in the towel. They said they had enough. They didn't want to dishoard any more from the existing above ground stocks because the demand at those prices were so great, they just didn't want to run the vaults completely bare. But this time around, it seems like they're running the vaults almost completely bare, given how much gold has moved from west to east over the past several years.
This would be a good time to remind everybody, too, a little bit more of a history lesson, that shackles came off when the gold pool was dissolved and prices headed higher. Then the new system of gold pooling was invented, and that's COMEX paper derivatives. The U.S. citizens, you recall, James, I'm sure you probably remember this well. January 1, 1975 was when the restriction was removed, allowing U.S. citizens to hold gold again. And anticipating that extra demand, COMEX paper gold futures were unveiled on December 31st, 1974. And that paper derivative system has served as the new gold pool for 35 years since, or 40 years since.
James, the other thing I think we should keep in mind, Craig, is that when they unleashed that price at $35 an ounce, we eventually went up to $850 an ounce. We went from extreme undervaluation to extreme overvaluation. And you're going to see the same thing this time as well. You're going to go from extreme undervaluation to extreme overvaluation. So when you're talking about extreme overvaluation, you know, a multiple of where we are today is what we have to be focusing on.
Agree completely. And so that leads to the first question that was posted to the site. And I can't remember who wanted me to ask this, but I'll ask it because I'm looking for my own answers on this one. You know, you and I, for the last couple of years, have obviously been dead wrong about the short-term direction of price. You know, as we've been pressed lower ever since QE3 started in October 2012, there seems like a rather defined program to move the stock market higher and everything else higher, but gold down. But how could we have been wrong? Heck, I even just posted, James, just yesterday, a report I found from Bank of America saying that by the end of 2013, they expected $2,000 gold, and by the end of 2014, they had $2,400 gold. But not just you and me. I mean, there's a lot of seven- and eight-figure analysts out there that got it wrong, too. What is the overriding factor that is that in your words, that has led price to go kind of counterintuitively these last couple of years?
Yeah. Well, you know, we're obviously seeing intervention in the gold market, and that's been pressuring prices. It really started in January of 2013, just after QE3 was announced in the United States. And that's when you started seeing significant periods of backwardation in the spot market in London versus the, you know, paper market in London, which in my mind is the more important market than the COMEX. You know, after Roosevelt confiscated gold in 1933, all of the metal trading went over to Europe, and even though it reopened in January 1975, as you mentioned, it only, for all practical purposes, reopened on the paper side. Even the gold that's mined here in the United States, most of that is exported out of the United States to where the physical markets are traded, which is principally London, and to a lesser extent, Zurich, although Shanghai itself is becoming very important as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you look back over the last couple of years, you know, I just say to myself, well, okay, you know, gold has been undervalued now for quite some time. I'm not a timer. Nobody can predict the future. When it comes to portfolio management, all we can basically do is accumulate the undervalued assets and get rid of overvalued assets. And for the past few years, you know, in my mind, you know, gold has been undervalued. But, you know, I take a different, a long-term approach on this thing, because when you're talking about gold, The way I view it, you know, this is something that has to be viewed over years, not just over weeks or months.
Right.
And what I've been saying since starting Gold Money back in 2001, gold is undervalued. It went up 12 years in a row, and it still remained undervalued, except because the dollar was being debased so much, almost lockstep with gold. And what you need to do is just accumulate this undervalued asset, because ultimately markets don't like undervaluation. They don't like overvaluation. And even with government intervention in a market will eventually reach fair value for an asset. And typically it goes beyond for fair value to extreme overvaluation, or the other way, extreme undervaluation. So, you know, for the past 15 odd years now, or 14 years since I started Gold Money, I've been saying just accumulate, you know, gold. Don't save dollars, don't save euros, or don't save any other national currency, because it doesn't make sense. You don't earn enough interest income on that savings to offset the risks that you're taking, that your bank might fail, or that the currency is going to be debased because of government policies of one sort or another. Instead, accumulate gold. So when you have your family, or silver for that matter, so when, at the end of the month, you know, within your family budget, the money that you're saving, because saving is obviously important, accumulating capital for the future, accumulate physical metal rather than accumulate any kind of national currency, because physical metal is the only money that really is undervalued at these levels. National currencies are all overvalued relative to gold.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, keep your perspective and your wits about you, recognizing that this is a long-term, who knows how long, but definitely, I mean, we're talking about long-term financial insurance and protection and saving in something other than fiat money, as you said.
Yeah, and there's another important point in this regard, Craig, that I probably should mention as well.
Sure.
You know, don't necessarily view gold as a way of, you know, getting rich or, you know, making a fortune. You know, if you're a professional trader, you can try, you know, trading fluctuations in the gold price to try make money that way. But that's for professional traders. That's not for most people. You know, this point about, you know, gold, it's just a sterile asset. It's no different than a stack of $100 bills. In order to make money with that $100 bills, you have to invest it. In order to make money with gold, you have to invest it. And what I'm saying here is that gold itself is not an investment. It's money. It doesn't generate wealth. It's just a way of preserving purchasing power over long periods of time. So if the price of gold rises in the currency in which you measure it, all you're doing is taking purchasing power away from the people who hold that currency and taking that purchasing power and putting it in your hands because you're holding gold. So you have to recognize, you know, that gold is money. It's not an investment. And once you start understanding that it's just a way of preserving purchasing power over long periods of time, it becomes much easier to put gold into your portfolio as a percentage of your overall assets.
That's an excellent description, James. I mean, that's as stated as clearly, and I hope everybody goes back and re-listens to what you just said. You know, gold is a store of wealth. If you want to accumulate extra wealth, then you invest. You know, maybe say other, like you said, maybe in other derivatives of gold, whether it's trading, maybe it's buying the miners, whatever. But the gold, the physical gold itself, is a store of wealth.
And one of the things that we have today that we've lost sight of and is very difficult to do, we try to perform economic calculation, you know, measuring the prices of goods and services in terms of a national currency. But national currencies are all over the place. We have to, first of all, measure purchasing power. And the way you measure purchasing power is you look at an asset and evaluate that asset in terms of a number of different currencies, including gold itself. So, for example, an ounce of gold today purchased basically the same amount of gold it did back in 1950. That's an example of how it preserves gold over purchasing power. How gold preserves purchasing power over long periods of time. But even this year, if you look at it, on January 1st of this year, a barrel of West Texas Intermediate cost 1.4 grams of gold. Today, a barrel of West Texas Intermediate costs 1.3 grams a barrel of oil. I'm talking about not gold, a barrel of oil.
I got you.
And so when you're looking at that, you can see that, gosh, I actually have more purchasing power with gold in terms of oil than I did at the beginning of the year. The problem is that all of these things are going up and down relative to each other. And I like to use the example, if you're standing on a rowboat looking back at the shore, you would swear that the land is going up and down, but we all know that you're actually going up and down in the rowboat. Trying to calculate with fiat currencies is like standing in the rowboat. What you have to do is you have to go back onto the shore and see that boat going up and down. And the way you do that is by calculating prices of goods and services in terms of ounces of gold or in terms of grams of gold.
Again, where else have you heard that explained as concisely as that? James, thank you. I hope everybody was paying close attention. I want to... we've got about five or six listener questions now stacked up, and I've got four or five more from email. So I think I better jump right into all of these subscriber and listener questions so we can get through them all in our remaining time. So if you're ready, here's the first one. Remember, they're going to skip around a little bit, but we try to answer as many as we can. This first one comes from Lyndon, and Lyndon wants to know what you think will happen if China's bid for inclusion in the IMF's SDR falls through and they don't get included. Are they going to some type of option B for setting up their own new financial system? What do you make of all that?
Yeah, I think it's an important development. We have to follow it. You know, China is flexing its muscles, and rightly so, because they've been generating a lot of wealth. They have a huge population that's been creating a lot of wealth. And they want an appropriate stature in world affairs. And if they're not treated as an equal, they're going to go their own way. And we've seen that in some respects already with the creation of this new infrastructure development bank that China is going to create and fund.
Yep.
That's basically a competitor to the World Bank. We have to remember that a lot of these institutions that, today are bandied about as, know-all organizations, they were created as a consequence of World War II. And they were dominated by the U.S. But the U.S. is no longer the dominant power that it once was economically. And all of these other countries want a fair shake as well. So, yes, I think China will ultimately go more and more independently and or with Russia. I mean, it's a natural marriage. Russia's got all of the resources, and China's got all of the people.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they have been moving together, and I think they will continue to move together. And it's primarily because of my view, the short-sighted policies that the U.S. government has pursued with regard to the dollar. You know, when the dollar became the international currency at the end of the Second World War under the Bretton Woods Agreement, it had a responsibility to the world community to maintain a unit of account that everybody could use that was fair, like it was under the classical gold standard when the British pound was the world currency. And that it would maintain its purchasing power and do all of the other things that sound money did, because back then the dollar was as good as gold. It's no longer the case, but back then it was the case. And not only have they destroyed the dollar as a unit of account, but even worse, the dollar has now become a political weapon so that the U.S. can try to beat up its enemies by choosing what they do or don't do with the dollar and the U.S. banking system.
Yep.
That ultimately impairs global commerce, and everybody suffers as a consequence when global commerce is impaired.
Excellent point. It will be interesting to see what happens. We had that IMF staff report earlier this week that made it look like they were going to hold them off for at least 12 months. Interesting times to live in, aren't they, James?
Yeah, they sure are.
All right, the next question comes from Gaz. Gaz wants to know, he says, time after time I hear precious metals investors talk about gold. Yet when pressed on the question of silver, they're quick to point out that they feel silver is even more undervalued than gold and has greater potential upside. Also has a longer history as money than gold. So, James, do you think it's justified? And maybe we should factor in the gold-silver ratio at this point. Do you think it's justified to hold more silver than gold?
Yeah, I do. But you're taking additional risk when you're doing that. What happened is that about 100 years ago, technological developments, industrial developments, changed the role of silver from primarily a monetary metal to a monetary as well as an industrial metal. So you have two competing demands for silver, as opposed to gold, which is demand primarily comes almost exclusively from being monetary metal. You know, even when gold is fabricated into jewelry in Asia and Hong Kong, which is most of the jewelry demand these days, it's fabricated that way because it's money. You know, they prefer fabrication in jewelry rather than coins and bars like we do here in the West. But the so these two competing demands on silver make it much more volatile. But the basic issues are this. There's 10 times more silver in the Earth's crust than there is gold. So logically, if they were identical, if their demands were identical, one would think that the price of silver would be 1/10 of the price of gold. But right now, it's 1/74 of the price of gold. So right. Silver is very, very cheap relative to gold. The historical norm is generally 16-1. Back in April of 2011, when silver got up to near $50 an ounce again, it was 31 ounces of silver equal to 1 ounce of gold. So at 74 ounces to one at the moment, silver is indeed cheap. But remember, you have more volatility with silver and more risk because of these two different demands. And therefore, it's not necessarily for everybody to have more silver than gold. My general recommendation is to have 2/3 gold and 1/3 silver. And if I'm correct in terms of the silver rate, gold-silver ratio falling, when we get to a much more normal level in the gold-silver ratio, just because of the falling ratio, you'll have equal amounts of gold and silver right. in your portfolio.
That makes sense. Silver will catch up, won't it?
Yes, that's what I view it that expect to happen. And I sort of view silver, Craig, as a gold substitute. In other words, when you have an ounce of gold, you have purchasing power outside the banking system. When you have 74 ounces of silver, you have the same amount of purchasing power outside the banking system. And when people start to understand that, gosh, you know, the banking system's in trouble, currencies are in trouble, governments have too much debt, et cetera, and they're going to look for alternatives, they'll say, well, gosh, silver is cheap relative to gold, so I expect that ratio to fall once again.
Though you sell, this is like my own question, though BitGold works in grams and fractions of a gram, so you don't need really small units of account like $15 silver. I mean, do you think for people that want to capitalize on that ratio, do you think there'll someday be a bit silver component to the BitGold platform?
Yeah, you know, it's possible that could develop, but you're right. You know, when you digitalize gold, you can go as many decimal places as you want to get as small a value as you want. And silver's role as a secondary currency compared to gold, you know, might be diminished in that regard. But that still doesn't change the fact that, you know, silver preserves purchasing power outside the banking system relative to gold. And if there's only 10 times more silver on the Earth's crust than there is than gold, you'd still think it would have a lower ratio, particularly given that the above-ground stock of silver is a fraction of what it is for gold, because silver does get consumed. It does disappear.
Right,
you know,
right.
Gold doesn't disappear. It's all the gold that's been mined throughout history still exists in this above-ground stock.
Excellent point. You've been, again, very generous with your time, and I know we really appreciate it. We're about 25 minutes into this already, so I'm going to speed along to the next couple of questions. Next one comes from Gabe, who states a lot of financial experts and pundits are speculating that a significant economic reckoning, a major reversion to the mean, is close at hand, maybe as soon as this fall. Do you foresee this being triggered, if it does happen, by some sort of sudden default or market failure, or would it be a gradual grinding deflationary downturn? And in either event, how would you see that playing out in the paper to physical metal markets?
Yeah. First of all, I don't see any deflation. I see asset destruction.
Yeah.
Like recently, you know, Puerto Rico defaulted. You had $72 billion of financial assets going out the window when they said they can't repay that debt. We saw a similar, you know, experience in Greece. So you're going to see asset destruction, but you're not going to see deflation because central banks are going to continue pumping up the quantity of money,
right.
The quantity of paper currency out there, national currencies. But with regard to the trigger, you can never predict these things. You know, typically, though, it comes out of the blue, and it comes when you're least expecting it. And it probably comes from an area that you're not really thinking about or don't necessarily think to be the key important point. But, I mean, there's so many potential flashpoints out there. You know, the real estate market in China, what that's going to do to the Chinese banks. You know, global tensions is a geopolitical tensions, you know, another element. Banking systems, though, derivatives and the banking systems are probably the area that we should be focusing on simply because there's so many bad loans on the balance sheet of banks.
Yeah.
And as a consequence of that, those banks cannot fulfill their promises to continue making good on the currencies that you have in your bank account. So what we saw in Cyprus, what we saw in Greece, what we saw in Iceland a few years ago, in my mind, is writing on the wall that the present system is unsustainable. And while we don't know what the future holds, it goes back to my point again about undervalued assets and overvalued assets. Not only is gold undervalued, but its 5,000-year history shows you that when these crises occur, that's an asset that is going to get you through a crisis. And I think that's the key element that we should be focusing on when we put gold into our portfolio.
Yeah, and I would add on this September-October timeframe thing and all of the different pundits that are now talking about it. Since I guess, am considered a pundit, I can speak to this. You know, everybody wants to make their bones with some kind of prediction that comes true. Like, you know, Joe Granville one time said the stock market was going to crash in 1987 and then it happened and he sold newsletters for 20 years after that. So when somebody says, watch out for this fall, and then there's a growing number of voices say that, they're all kind of jumping on the same bandwagon because then they start thinking, well, if it does happen this fall, I want to be able to say that I predicted it too. So there's kind of a feedback loop there of folks all wanting to be right. So I would be wary. At least I personally, I'm still wary of that particular prediction, but we'll see. James, from last of the email questions from Peter, wants to know, talking of Bitgold, he said he saw that there were 100,000 new accounts that were opened there in July. Probably had to do with the U.S. being available in U.S. So your perspective, James, in light of the physical tightness, can you give any boots on the ground report on coming up with all of the gold that's necessary to fill those accounts? Are you seeing tightness as you're trying to take delivery?
There were 100,000 accounts open, but you have to remember that Bitgold is appealing to people who never bought gold before, mm-hmm. and the average account size in Bitgold is less than $100.
Got it.
Whereas in gold money, you know, the average account size is $70,000 or $75,000. It's a big difference. You know, if you go out in most places and you want to buy $10,000 worth of gold, even $100,000 worth of gold, it's typically not an issue. It's when you're talking about hedge fund size, you know, $25 million of gold, $50 million of gold, you got to wait a few weeks. And waiting a few weeks, and even though you're buying spot, is basically the same thing as backwardation.
Yes.
It's showing that there's tightness in the physical market that isn't necessarily reflected in prices, but is reflected in the amount of time you have to wait to actually have delivery made to you.
Got it. All right. I've got about six or seven questions in queue now from folks that have been listening to us visit. So I want to get to them lastly here. And again, this is the advantage of this format. If you have questions, if you're listening right now, you have questions, something you've always wanted to ask Mr. Turk, just type it into your questions tab here on your control panel, and I'll forward it as we go along. The first one comes from Matt, and I don't know much about this one, but you might. He said, how is Bitgold different from e-gold, which apparently this e-gold was once shut down and prosecuted by the U.S. government for money laundering. So how is Bitgold, this sounds probably an easy one, how is Bitgold different from that, and how will it avoid the same fate?
There's so many ways in which it's different. You know, we'd spend the rest of this seminar talking about it. The bottom line is that Bitgold does everything legally. E-gold did not. That's the quick answer to the question. But the bigger important point is that, you know, BitGold is based in Canada. eGold was based in the United States. BitGold follows all of the Canadian rules and regulations. And BitGold, the parent company, is now called Gold Money Incorporated, which is traded on the Toronto Stock Exchange. And as a consequence, not only do you have the normal regulatory things that a financial institution applies to, as well as the internal governance procedures that you have in BitGold and Gold Money for that matter, you now have the additional regulatory oversight as a publicly listed, publicly traded company.
And definitely all that different reporting and everything else that definitely should lend extra confidence to anybody that is a BitGold account holder. And again, we're talking fully allocated gold, correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's fully allocated gold. You own it. It's stored wherever you want to store it in different countries around the world. And in BitGold, you can spend it if you want to spend it, provided you're not a U.S. resident. That spending mechanism is not available to U.S. residents. So again, that's a differentiation between what BitGold is and what eGold did.
Right.
But the big one was that, you know, BitGold operates completely legally. eGold did not.
In terms of that spending part, I would imagine that's something that's being worked on.
Yeah, it really depends on the political and regulatory environment in the United States. It's not a technological issue.
Yeah, I
would imagine. It's when the federal government and the various states get their act together and decide when they're willing to enable gold to circulate as currency in competition to the U.S. dollar.
Well, I won't hold my breath for that to happen next week, but I like the possibility. I'm certain that's coming at some point.
It may not happen next week, but remember, technology always changes things.
Right, right.
Remember 100 years ago when the cotton automatic weaving machines started in England, the Luddites were fighting that. But, you know, eventually technology makes life easier. It makes costs less, makes things more efficient. And there are Luddites today in the payment system, but ultimately the technology is going to change it. And that's the exciting thing about BitGold and its vision,
yep.
Which is something we at Gold Money wholeheartedly agree with. You know,
yep.
Technology does change things.
Agreed. All right, our next question comes from Carl, and I'm going to kind of amend his question just a little bit. He wants to know why the leaders of the major PM companies like yours, Sprott, Jim Sinclair, haven't banded together and launched some sort of counterattack as the markets have been decimated in recent years. I'm going to kind of amend that a little bit because we're all doing, you're doing what you need to do to draw, shine the light on this, as is Jim and everybody else. Let me kind of take that in a different direction. You know, these mining shares are just getting the snot beat out of them on a daily basis. The HUI index is back to where it was in 1997, crying out loud. You know, but yet we've got, you know, Keith Neumeyer at First Majestic, and that's about it, willing to call a spade and go out there and try to do something about it. Why do you think these, you know enough mining executives, what's their deal, Jim? How come they just kind of take this all laying down?
Yeah. You know, there are a number of people in the mining industry who understand gold, but most of them don't. They just see gold as something that's pulled out of the ground, and from them, being mining engineers by background rather than financial people by background, they just see their aim in life is to get gold out of the ground, you know, cheaply. It, to them, they don't care whether they're mining gold or coal for all practical purposes.
Yeah.
We're just generally with regard to the other point about banding together, only governments are allowed to form cartels.
That's true.
You know, if we tried to band together, the government would probably try suing everybody. So what you do is you have to operate independently from one another in a competitive marketplace. And it comes down, in my mind, to education. You know, the more we can get more people educated, and this is one of the aims of BitGold, and it's historically been one of the aims of Gold Money. Let people get the information, make their own decision, and as they get that information and start educating themselves about money in particular and portfolio management in general, they'll understand the importance of gold and silver, and eventually the anti-gold forces will be overrun, just like they were back in 1968.
Yep. All right, let me move on. Next one comes from CPE. This is probably a pretty simple one, but he wants to know, what do you say to those who say, if you don't hold it, then you don't own it? It's kind of an endorsement of Gold Money, I would say.
Yeah, there's two points that I'd like to say here. First of all, he's hitting to the difference between paper gold and physical gold, which is an important distinction to make. You know, if you're a trader and you want to profit from fluctuations in the price, okay, trade paper gold. But if you're looking to protect yourself with money outside the banking system, then you have to own physical gold. Now, the question is, when you buy physical gold, there are only two things you can do. You buy it and store it yourself, or you buy it and you have someone store it with you. Now, both have its advantages and disadvantages, and you have to weigh these advantages and disadvantages up and make some basic conclusions. But my own view is that you really want to diversify. You want to have some gold that you store yourself, but don't store it in a bank or a bank safe deposit box.
Right.
As we saw in Greece, you know, nobody could get their gold when the banking system was closed there. You want to store it, you know, at home. You know, I'm in favor of, you know, burying it if that's what you feel comfortable with. But the point is that how much do you want to have buried in your backyard or, you know, hidden in your basement? If you have 5, 10,000, sure, maybe even 25,000 or 50,000. But if you have $1 million worth of gold, or even 100,000 or 50,000, do you really want to take the risk of storing that yourself?
Right.
You really need professional storage. And if you go, you know, with gold money or bit gold, something like that, you want to make sure you have the allocated storage, where it's gold that is stored in your name in a vault that's in the business of storing. In other words, you want to use any of the big name storage companies like we have in Bitgold and Gold Money. And that gold is stored, it's insured. And with Gold Money you can, and Bitgold too, you can put that gold in different countries around the world, which is a great way of diversifying political risk and geographic risk. So, yeah, you hold it, but you don't necessarily hold it in your hand. You're holding it in a vault somewhere safe and secure in another part of the world.
Yep. That dovetails into the next question. This one comes from Jay. And I'm not, again, if this is not one you want to go down this road, feel free to just add, you know, that's not something I want to get specific about. But Jay's question is, what's a reasonable percentage of net worth that you've seen people put into precious metals to preserve purchasing power, to protect wealth?
Yeah, that's a good question. Again, I'm not going to make specific advice for any
right.
individual because first of all, it's not my area of expertise, and I don't know everybody's individual circumstances, but there is a general rule that I follow that's worth thinking about. The percentage of gold that you own, particularly at current levels with gold being relatively undervalued, should be equal to your age. So if you're 25, you should have maybe 25% of your overall wealth in gold.
Okay.
If you're 75, you should have about 75% of your wealth in gold. And the reason is that the older you become, the more risk adverse you should be. And as a consequence, you want more liquidity and more preservation of purchasing power, more safe haven. Therefore, you increase your gold holding as you get older. When you're younger, you can have more money invested in stocks and real estate and other alternatives, but those should decrease as you accumulate more wealth and become older. Because when you're older, you want to have the assurance of knowing that your purchasing power is there and available
yeah.
should you need it, you know, for holidays or for emergency purposes.
If I can elaborate on that for a minute, you know, back when I first became a stockbroker back in 1990, and if anybody's dealt with financial planners or have done any financial planning themselves, they may recall that same kind of formula, but it's often used with the percentage of bonds that you should have. You know, you might have 25% of your portfolio in bonds when you're 25. You might have 75% of your portfolio in bonds when you're 75. And I think you make such a great point, James, because really, in the world that we currently live in, would you rather increase your percentage exposure to debt as you get older, or would you rather increase your percentage exposure to sound money as you get older?
And you're making an important point here, Craig, because you know, when you look at wealth, it comes in two different forms. It comes in financial assets and tangible assets. Financial assets have counterparty risk. You're based,
yep.
you're reliant upon someone's promise. What about the, you know, 70-year-old guy who owned Puerto Rican bonds? What
right.
does he do now?
Yep.
Whereas if you own physical gold, you don't have, because it's a tangible asset, you don't have counterparty risk. You're basing your ownership of purchasing power on 5,000 years of history.
Yep. All right, James, I've got just a couple left, so I'll try to speed through these pretty quickly. Clark guy wants to know what he's seen predictions of fair value of gold from 3,000 to 7,000 up to 50,000. And I always answer that myself. You know, we're basing off of money supply, M1, M2, and how do you know what the denominator is? Because you don't know how much gold there really is. But what do you think, James? You have a number that you carry around in your back pocket as to what you think a fair value would be, and how do you come up with it?
Yeah, 12,000 is my fair value, and actually come up with it in three different ways, and they're explained in detail in the book, The Money Bubble.
Okay.
But basically what I'm doing is I'm taking gold and comparing it to the amount of money, national currencies out there in the world.
Yep.
It's looking on a historical basis what would normally represent the fair value of gold versus the amount of paper currencies, national currencies out there. And 12,000 is my fair value. And so, as I mentioned earlier, in 1980, we were above fair value when we got up to $150 an ounce. So I think when this bull market in gold is finally over, we can probably expect something above 12,000. And also that 12,000 number is based on the amount of national currencies that are in existence today.
Today.
You know, if central banks continue to expand the amount of national currencies, that's ultimately going to be a higher gold price. I mean, we have to ask ourselves, you know, 100 years ago, gold was $20.67 an ounce. Then it was $35. Then we went through the hundreds in the 70s and the 80s. Now we've been in the thousands. Why is that? Why don't we go back to $20.67 an ounce? It's simply because there's so much paper, so many dollars have been created relative to the amount of gold that exists. And that gold still has that purchasing power preservation factor that I was talking about, because the above ground quantity of gold, what I call gold's M3, grows approximately the same rate as world population growth and new wealth creation. So, you know, even though there's now like 172,000 metric tons in the above ground gold stock compared to half that, maybe 70 years or so ago, gold still preserves purchasing power, because it's growing at the same rate as population growth and wealth creation. Not national currencies aren't doing that.
Right, right. Well, and to that end, of purchasing power and everything else, Scott's question is, as you look into your crystal ball, what will everyday life look like 2 or 3 years from now in terms of shopping, eating out, traveling, banking, et cetera? Kind of, do you envision the more of this, the current system holding on, and but just everything being more expensive, or
that's really a tough question to answer. I've lived in 7 different countries around the world, and I've traveled to over 50. I've been in a lot of third world countries that have gone through currency collapses, and you know, even a place like Russia, which was a major, you know, the Soviet Union, when the Soviet Union collapsed, or they had 2 currency collapses in the 1990s for all practical purposes. You could go to a Russian person on the street and say the Soviet Union was going to collapse next year, and life is going to be entirely different, and not one person in 100 would have said that would happen, because they would say that the government won't let it happen. And I think that you're going to get a similar response here if you ask Americans, well, nothing's going to change because the government won't let it happen.
Right.
But the reality is that things do change. And it could change not only from a monetary and financial point of view, but it could change in regard to this question, you know, how we live our lives. I mean, bad situations do develop from time to time. We've been fortunate in the United States that if there has been a bad situation, it's been pretty much locally controlled and hasn't affected the whole country.
Yeah.
But a currency collapse brings an entirely new, different element of worry and concern. And if there is a currency collapse, you have to be prepared that life as we know it is going to change, which is always a reason for thinking internationally. Because if it changes in the country where you live, it may not change in, you know, 75 other countries around the world where you can go live temporarily and be out of the chaos and live relatively comfortably if you plan for it and have that international diversification as part of your portfolio strategy.
Excellent point. And that'd be a fun topic to explore more in depth the next time we get together, James, because that's something that's on a lot of folks' minds. In the meantime, I mean, we're about 45 minutes. Would you mind if I took a couple more minutes and just ask you the rest of these questions? Is that okay?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
All right. Neil has a question that has to do with mining shares. Given that it seems bankers can naked short mining shares to oblivion, quite possibly resulting in bankruptcies, will bankers become the beneficial owners of the bankrupted companies and their in-ground assets if that happens?
Well, yeah, typically that's what would happen if there is a bankruptcy. And, you know, the miners, they've gone through tough times, and a lot of the people who've destroyed capital, you know, the CEOs, have been shown the door, which is a good thing. You know, the ones that are there and are still operating, producing gold, generating cash flow, you know, they are the survivors. So while there may be a couple more bankruptcies, I think the ones that are operating today are the ones that are going to continue operating for the foreseeable future. I think that would be my best guess.
If you made it this far, for crying out loud.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, I can answer Arthur's question. He wants to know if you can use Bitcoin to buy Bitcold. I saw that option when I opened my account. So the answer is yes, Arthur. Hey, look, I'm doing my own ATA now, James. Finally, from Carl, this is his usual question. He says, If China is the one that's accumulating, and you know, and I've made this point for years. I mean, I remember trading commodities in the 80s. You know, the Chinese had come in and they'd dump and sell wheat futures to drive the price of wheat down right before placing a major order for wheat. And so there's a lot of theories that they are heavy players in the gold paper market to drive it down and accumulate as much gold for their dollar foreign exchange reserves as they can. So Carl's question is, why on earth would China allow gold to move up in any significance until they're finished with their accumulation?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a good point. But there's, I think, a more important, broader issue. China by itself is not going to be accused. It's not going to do anything that would enable it to be accused of bringing down the global monetary system.
That's true.
They don't want to be pointed out as the people that, you know, broke the system, the Bretton Woods system. I think they're going to allow the U.S. government to hang itself, and then everybody will know that it was the U.S. government was responsible for the system, you know, coming down and all of the chaos that's created as a consequence of, you know, the dollar losing its role as the world's reserve currency. So yeah. China, the other thing I think you have to keep in mind is I lived in Asia for many years and I did a lot of business with overseas Chinese businessmen. They're very long-term oriented. You know, they're not only focusing on the rest of their life, they're focusing on their kids' lives as well. So they view their policies as one over multi-generational.
Mm-hmm.
They're not necessarily going to do anything in the short term of consequence. But they're going to continue to game the system the way they have been. They're going to continue keeping the yuan at a currency that's going to enable them to generate reserves, and they're going to spend those reserves wherever they possibly can. You know, buying resources in Africa, accumulating physical gold, trying to buy shares of different companies that they think are important investments through, you know, China's sovereign wealth fund.
Right.
So it's an important geopolitical juncture that we're at, but China is not going to do anything, I think, that would destroy the present international monetary system.
At least until the point is that they're ready to do it. I mean, as you said, they're very patient people, and when they recognize that the time has come, perhaps that'll be the point when they do it.
I think what will happen by that. Their gradual approach, you know, like creating this new infrastructure bank, incrementally they're going to change things. But by then, you know, the problems with the dollar will be so apparent that they won't be blamed for crashing the system.
Right, right.
It'll just be a natural evolution in the system.
Right, right. And endure the military wrath of those that used to have the power. All right,
well,
James.
That's the point, Craig, because, you know, monetary battles often turn into war.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we really have to avoid at all costs. And hopefully we will avoid that when we have monetary chaos in the future.
Yep.
But, you know, given all of the military prowess being flexed to various parts around the world today, we have to be aware of the possibility that a war could break out if we have monetary chaos.
Well, and history is replete with examples of pretty chaotic transitions from one financial reserve currency system to another. I mean, it doesn't usually just go, oh, okay, now it's your turn. Okay, we'll just take what's
coming to us.
James, you've been extraordinarily generous with your time. I suppose it's time to wrap up, but the tradition here at TFMR as we end these is to end with the final four, just four quick, fun questions just that you can usually answer with a one-word sentence, you know, one word or a sentence or something like that. So if you're ready, we kind of we can head right into that, if that's all right.
Okay.
All right, tomorrow is the NFP, the BLSBS, as we call it here in Turdville. A lot of folks are wondering what that number is going to be and whether the Fed will raise rates as soon as September or December. What do you think? Were the Fed going to raise rates this year?
I've been consistently saying that the Fed's never going to raise rates because the U.S. government can't afford to pay a fair rate of interest.
Correct.
So all they've been doing is talking about it. I mean, we should have seen rates rise a couple of years ago when unemployment by the U.S. government statistics went below 6.5%. That's what Bernanke was telling us. We went well below that level. Rates never went up. Rates were supposed to go up at the Fed's meeting back in June. That's what they were telling us at the beginning of the year. Did they go up? No. All they're doing is jawboning. You know, the Fed realizes, I think, that they're in a situation where they can't raise rates, because if they raise rates, that's going to hyperinflate the U.S. dollar. So they're trying to delay the inevitable. But the consequence of zero interest rates is that they're destroying capital. They're destroying the middle class. Yep. They're destroying savings. And that's probably just as bad as if they were to allow the dollar to hyperinflate.
Yep. All right. Here in the summer of 2016, the current U.S. presidential battle is Trump versus Hillary. When it's all said and done and we get through the conventions next year, what's your guess? Who's going to be the two candidates from the two major parties?
I don't have a clue, but the only candidate I've ever supported is Ron Paul.
Yeah, I hear you there. And I liked Rand for a while, but gosh, he's been disappointing as of late. All right, we'll put you down as not knowing and not necessarily too concerned about it either.
It's not going to change.
Yeah.
It's not going to change. You're going to see big government regardless which party gets involved.
The Republicrats are still going to be in charge. Yep. James, do you own any platinum? That's question number three.
Yeah, I do own a little bit. And the reason why is, again, it's just a form of diversification. You know, platinum has never been confiscated by government. That doesn't mean it's not going to happen in the future. You know, they might say that because I own platinum, I'm a speculator, and therefore I'm going to be punished as a speculator and confiscate my platinum. But yeah, I do see it as a diversifier. But you know, my recommendation is have no more than 3-4%, maybe 5% at most in your portfolio in the PGMs, platinum and palladium.
Yeah, you know, some folks use it, you know, as historical ratios here. It's less expensive than gold at this point, you know, as a way to kind of move some money out of gold into platinum and back and forth, like they do with gold and silver sometimes too.
Yeah, I don't see it that way. I just see it as a diversifier because platinum hasn't been confiscated.
Okay. And lastly, I think I've asked you this before, and I think I recall the answer, but you know, it's almost football season. You have a favorite NFL team that you follow?
I don't follow them as closely as I used to, but I'm a Patriots fan, you know, given my house in New Hampshire.
I guess that's true. And do you inflate your balls all the way, James?
No comment.
Just
I think Brady was screwed. You know?
Spoken like a Pats fan.
James, don't get me started on it.
James, hey, thank you so much. What an informative, almost an hour. It's just extraordinarily valuable information you've given us. Again, I just want to give a ringing endorsement for what you've done in merging gold money and BitGold, and just advise everybody to check that out. What a great way to accumulate gold and do it without a premium too, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So, and when we look at premiums out there and think about, oh, I don't want to pay, you know, an extra $30 an ounce or whatever, well, here's a way to get around it. James, thank you so much. And it's going to be a rather interesting end of the year, and maybe we can do this again as we approach 2016 and see how the world looks then.
Okay, I'd be happy to do it, Craig.
All right, my friend. Have a great rest of your day, and good luck tomorrow with all the NFP madness.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
Thanks.